Jag heter Per Dahlqvist och du lyssnar på Perspektiv, en podd från Vad vi vet.
We know from science that in order to meet the 1.5 degree warming goal, emissions have to have peaked already now, basically, 2020, and need to go down from here. So in order to stabilize the climate at any temperature, we actually have to completely stop adding carbon to the atmosphere.
Som du vet lever vi över våra tillgångar. Vi konsumerar som om det inte fanns någon morgondag. Vi köper saker vi inte behöver för pengar vi inte har för att imponera på människor vi inte känner. Och under en lång tid har planeten betalat fakturan. Det där har skötts i bakgrunden på något sätt som inte riktigt märks. Men det som hänt de senaste åren är att planeten börjat skicka fakturor till oss. Vädret har blivit instabilt och extremt. Det är mer torka och mer regn, och inte bara i världen utan också här hemma i Sverige. På sommaren är det numera alltid ont om vatten på Öland, det är Blekinge och på många andra ställen. På vintern, ja, Svealand har numera Götalands väder. Det blir liksom aldrig riktigt kallt, och det blir framförallt inte kallt under lång tid. Det beror på att medeltemperaturen på jorden redan ökat med 1,14 grader i dagsläget, enligt NASA som håller koll på det där. Och det här har fått isarna att smälta i en takt vi aldrig sett innan. Världshaven har höjts med 20 centimeter under det senaste århundradet, och den takten har ökat för varje år under det här seklet. Temperaturen i haven har också ökat med 0,3 grader. Och här mäter man då de översta 100 meterna vatten i haven. Och även här är det NASAs data jag stödjer mig på. Men att bli deprimerad hjälper faktiskt inte. Och framförallt har det noll nytta. Så jag har funderat mycket på det här. Hur ska vanligt folk, alltså du och jag, i den mån vi kan betraktas som normala människor, hur kan vi förändra vår livsstil för att inte bidra med utsläppen och därmed förvärra klimatförändringarna? Frågan är förstås, var börjar man och vilka insatser spelar roll? Att fortsätta som man gjort innan och bara klimatkompensera, eller köpa ekologiska t-shirts som man inte behöver istället för vanliga t-shirts man inte behöver, det hjälper ju ingen. Så vad spelar egentligen roll? Ingen är bättre lämpad än Kimberly Nicholas att svara på den frågan. Hon är lektor vid Lunds universitet och hennes forskning handlar om kopplingen mellan människor, naturen och klimatet. Hon blev en superstjärna i klimatforskarkretsar för några år sedan när hon och en annan forskare, Seth Waynes, publicerade sin studie High Impact Actions for Individuals to Reduce Greenhouse Gas Emissions. Och den fick en stor genomslagskraft även utanför forskarkretsar. Hon var intervjuad både här och där, och liksom en av de grejerna som togs fram i studien var just vilken stor påverkan som det har att skaffa ett barn till. Och det stämmer såklart, och det kommer hon att prata mer om i vårt samtal. Och sen författare till en bok som heter Under the Sky We Make, How to Be Human in a Warming World, som är väldigt fin och intressant att läsa. Innan vi börjar, om du inte redan prenumererat på podden, passa på att göra det nu för att inte missa ett kommande avsnitt. Och om du inte riktigt vet den här podden något för dig, ja, men vänta då tills du lyssnar färdigt eller kolla in alla tidigare avsnitt. Jag lovar att du alltid hittar något som intresserar dig. Som alltid, når du mig på perspektiv@vadvivet.se. perspektiv@vadvivet.se med tankar och tyckerier och förslag på människor jag borde prata med eller ämnen som jag borde vara intresserad av. Med det sagt, här är dags för Kimberly Nicholas. I read somewhere recently, someone said that actually when it comes to climate change, the planet doesn't need us. It's we who need to change in order to be able to adapt to the climate. But the climate on the planet has always changed and will continue to do so, even after we're gone. Is that a fair assessment if we start off in a sort of more dystopic part of this conversation?
Well, on the scale of the universe or the scale of the history of life on Earth over billions of years, that's certainly true. I mean, the planet existed before there was any life on it, and certainly long before there was any human life, and will probably continue to exist at least for another billion years. At that point, the sun is going to start getting warmer and brighter and eventually probably swallow planet Earth. So Earth itself is not going to be around forever and ever. But a billion years is a very long time. And it's really fascinating to know that from, you know, the science and the researchers who are studying those kind of phenomena at the scale of the universe. But for those of us alive on Earth, I think it's maybe a little more relevant to think, okay, we are the only planet where we know that there's life, and we're currently killing off a lot of it and driving many species to extinction and really endangering our own lives and our own civilizations with catastrophic climate change. So we better focus on that right now and in the next decade, which is really critical. And then we have, you know, about a billion years to figure out a plan B beyond planet Earth. But that's not our top, top priority at the moment.
I think there's also a case of sort of the frog that is in water that is getting increasingly hot. You don't understand that it's getting hotter until suddenly it's burning on your skin. And in your case, I know that you said somewhere that your family memories or your childhood were burning because you grew up in Sonoma. How's that like? Because you were you trapped there, or did you go there voluntarily during the great fires of California this year? Or what could you say about that?
We know from research that people do respond like frogs in slowly heating water. And actually, there's this constantly shifting baseline, which so far in my lifetime has been shifting in the wrong direction, that we're adding a lot of climate pollution, we're warming and destabilizing the climate, and we're driving life on Earth to disintegrate, basically. But people are really bad at noticing this because we have this issue of the shifting baseline. So there's lots of research that's shown that we kind of accept as a new normal whatever this continually degraded state is. And I think that's really tragic, actually, and very problematic. But it was really different for me personally to experience that this past summer. So in general, I have cut my flying about 90%. I don't fly at all within Europe. And the only flying I haven't stopped doing yet is going back to North America to see my family. And I would normally not do that at all during the pandemic, but my dad actually got COVID this summer and was in the hospital. And I decided to go back and be with my family over the summer. Thankfully, he made a great recovery. He's doing fine. But I was there. So he had just come home from the hospital. We were, you know, taking care of him and getting those plans in place. And then the latest of the last 5 years of catastrophic wildfires in California took off. So it was in August, you know, a few months ago. And I literally opened a letter from my insurance company that they were not renewing insurance on a farmhouse that I used to live in and that I inherited from my grandparents and have thought about potentially retiring in. So they've decided it's too dangerous for fire risk to insure it. And a few hours later, this catastrophic fire took off near my parents' house. So then we were in the situation of, you know, my dad was not able to leave the house, actually. He had just had knee surgery, had had a fall, and that was why he had ended up in the hospital in the first place. So then it was like, wait a minute, there's an out of control wildfire that could be headed this way. We don't have an evacuation plan to safely get my dad out of the house. There are a lot of stairs and other logistics that, you know, we would need to make arrangements for. We haven't done that. And it just felt so terrifying to be there. And also for me personally, to see how scary it is when there's ash falling from the sky. And, you know, of course, this is also during the pandemic. So I'm only eating outside. I don't want to be in my parents' house without a mask. And I'm eating outside and there's ash falling on my body and in my food. And, you know, this was ash from somebody's house and somebody's life going up in smoke and flames and being carried over to me. So it was just felt like nowhere was safe because it wasn't safe to be outside with the smoke from the fires. It wasn't safe to be inside because of the COVID risk. So yeah, it felt terrifying. And it also felt really scary and worrisome to see family and friends who have been living with this kind of elevated risk that has just completely changed. I mean, flipped basically in 2015 to a new state where these catastrophic wildfires have been happening every fall. And we know from research that that is linked with human-caused climate change, that these longer, warmer summers, earlier snow melts, meaning less water, longer droughts, more risk of big fires, especially late in the season in the fall, which is when they've been happening, are linked to climate change and elevating the risks from land management and other things. So yeah, it felt kind of how people have grown accustomed to this. And, you know, my brother-in-law said, oh yeah, I know you're really freaked out. This is your first fire, but you know, it's not really bad until the ashes that are falling are the size of, you know, a quarter, which would be like 2 or 3 centimeters in diameter. It's like, no, it's really bad. You know, the ash being like, I don't know, 4 millimeters falling on me is enough to be really bad. Like, this is already really bad.
Have you noticed a change when you're going back and forth since you're not there all the time?
Well, certainly this summer, that was a really, I mean, dramatic, huge change. And obviously, I mean, there have historically been wildfires in the American West for sure, but the interval, and there was one when I was growing up, when I was just starting college, that would have been in like 1995 or 96, that fire. But that was the last one that I remember until 2017. And then there's been one every year since then that's been close enough to affect my family. So that's clearly a huge change. And, you know, the fact that my insurance is not being renewed, and I've now talked to a lot of people about that, including, you know, my insurance agent, who said, yeah, there are a lot of companies who are trying to just get out of California entirely. Like, they don't think it's a feasible market to insure anymore, and they want to leave the state altogether. So there are clearly big changes afoot. I think there's a range of responses. I mean, I see people who are recognizing the need to learn to live better with fire. And a friend who's a researcher at Stanford, Rebecca Miller, who's focusing on the California fires, I've learned a lot from her and other colleagues that how important it is for people to take personal and community responsibility, that basically the biggest factor that will make it safer to live there is for people, homeowners, to take care of their properties, to make their houses more fire resistant, to have what's called defensible space, so not have vegetation and stuff around the house. So it's a lot of small things. But then, of course, there's a system level to that of, you know, where are people allowed to build new homes and what kind of standard do those homes need to meet? And those need to be taken with fire safety in mind, basically. But I think, yeah, I would say I hadn't felt it viscerally how different it is until this past year. I'm usually going home around the Christmas holidays, and I think the changes have been less noticeable in that time of year. So, you know, it's kind of felt typical for me, or like how I remembered it growing up. I have been afraid of it changing and of it feeling different. And I was actually really relieved, you know, the beginning of August when I was there, then my focus, I wasn't thinking about fire. My focus was on, you know, health and my family and my dad's recovery. And I was really appreciating how beautiful where I grew up is and how lovely actually the weather in the summer was. And, you know, these things that I remember from childhood of the crickets singing at night and these warm days, but cool nights. And it did feel kind of how I remembered. And then it felt like really overnight, there was just this flip and everyone was commenting on how weird and hot it was and how humid. And that's really unusual for there. And people are noticing the dramatic changes.
Thinking of sort of the different mentality in the US and in Sweden, since you have experience in both worlds, in the US, there's just this longing for the ability to make your own choices and we should minimize government interference and so on. Whereas here we've gone sort of the other way. And I feel that sometimes, you know, when you talk to people here, there's this notion that, well, I guess that's the state taking care of this somehow, or I don't know, there's some sort of vague idea that maybe it's the prime minister who's switching off something, or there will be a rules and regulations that will take care of this rather than that you look at your own personal responsibility and so on. And now that I've been sort of studying up a bit more on the Paris Accord and how it's going, I found this sort of, there's this group called the Climate Action Tracker, and they are a coalition of scientists and political analysts, basically. And they say how well are countries now stepping up to reach the Climate Accord agreements, and what are the effects proposed? Will they be enough? Will they be highly insufficient and insufficient, and so on? And what strikes me when getting on that map, I mean, the US is critically insufficient, which is no surprise given the last year's administration. But Sweden is also on the insufficient scale at this thing. And I think there's this tendency that I sort of tend to grapple with myself, and that sort of, you said there will be much more of this in the future, and we think that there's something else going to take care of, and so on. So I think it comes down to this, that the world isn't doing enough, and not even the state. And then it's sort of, do I do enough?
Great question. I mean, my view on it is that there has to be this, in a healthy democracy, there has to be this interaction between citizens and the state. And I think in Sweden, there is much greater trust in the government, and that trust is really important. We know from research that trust is kind of the social glue that holds societies together. And I think it's really critical to cultivate that and to earn it also. I mean, it needs to be based on being trustworthy, upkeeping promises and behaving in an honorable way and meeting agreements and so on. I think what you said about Climate Action Tracker, that's really important for people to understand. The last time I looked, there is only one country in the world that is actually on track for meeting the 1.5 degrees target. So the whole point of the Paris Agreement is to stabilize the climate before exceeding intolerable damage. And the way we'll measure that is by stabilizing it between 1.5 and 2 degrees of global warming. And we know from IPCC and other research, it's much safer and much better, both for societies and for nature, if we can meet that 1.5 degree goal. But right now, there's only one country, the Gambia, who's actually on track to deliver that goal. The only major emitter that is anywhere close to meeting that goal is India, is judged sufficient to meet the 2-degree target. And then, as you mentioned, the US, even the EU, China, the other major emitters are all insufficient to critically insufficient. So the message from that is the world is not doing enough. Governments aren't doing enough. Individuals aren't doing enough. Businesses aren't doing enough. Nobody's doing enough. Maybe Greta is doing enough. Like, I think she's doing all she can. And certainly I don't want to diminish the efforts of, there are certainly people who are working really hard and throwing themselves into this with everything they've got. But we haven't reached a critical mass yet of where we will need to reach very quickly, this social tipping point where suddenly, you know, actually money is no longer being invested in fossil fuels. It's being invested in clean energy. We aren't subsidizing the things that are harming the climate. We've actually made the investments we need.
Something you said was stuck. It's a social tipping point we need to reach before we can reach our climate tipping point. I mean, all the Paris Accord is going to make sure that we reach a tipping point of emissions around 2030. That's why people talk so much about it. But still, the social tipping point has to come earlier. Do we have research on what is needed for people to understand that they actually have to be involved in this? This is basically a joke, but I'll tell you anyway. It's sort of, Swedes often talk about if there should be a sugar tax to avoid us being fat on sugar. And people say that they feel very strongly that there should be some kind of state intervention in order to prevent us from getting more sugar in our bodies. Whereas the solution would be much more simple. That was basically to close your mouth and stop drinking soda every now and then. It's difficult to understand that I am the problem. What would be needed to understand that I'm the problem? My behavior is the problem. I eat too much bad stuff for the climate and maybe also for my health, or I consume too much, or I sort of do these strange little things. Like when you buy things that are organic, you buy a t-shirt of organic cotton and you feel good about yourself, even though you're just stupid, but in a slightly greener way, because no one actually needs another t-shirt, or perhaps not even another garment.
Just to make sure we're clear on the starting point. So we know from science that in order to meet the 1.5 degree warming goal, emissions have to have peaked already now, basically 2020, and need to go down from here. So in order to stabilize the climate at any temperature, we actually have to completely stop adding carbon to the atmosphere. And that's kind of hard to get our minds around, because many of the goals earlier were about reducing by, you know, 50 or 80% or something like this. But we know that that's not going to be enough. We actually have to get all the way to zero and completely stop adding carbon to the atmosphere. And that's because it lasts, some of it, for 10,000 years. So if you think about, you know, Stonehenge and the Great Pyramids, those are somewhere around 5,000 years old. The carbon that we're emitting from burning fossil fuels today is going to be in the atmosphere twice as long as the Great Pyramids. Some of it will be around that long. So that's why it really has to go to zero. And to do that in time for 1.5 degrees, we need to be reducing emissions something like 8% per year. So far, Sweden has been on track about 1% to 2% per year. So even Sweden, which is often held up as a model and is doing many things right, really isn't doing enough and could be doing and needs to be doing so much more.
And the reason for us to stop emitting CO2 at this point is basically the concept of a supertanker. If we stop adding more speed, it will slowly slow down. But at this moment, we're accelerating the warming. Is that the way you can put it?
I think so, yeah. I usually think of, I mean, certainly the climate system is like a supertanker. It's obviously a very big system, the scale of the whole planet. It has many parts, the ocean, the atmosphere, the land, what people are doing that are interacting over different timescales. I usually think about the carbon bathtub, where you think, okay, our pollution that we're adding to the atmosphere, that's like water coming out of the faucet and filling a tub. And there is a drain at the bottom that's removing some of our pollution. Right now, that's the oceans and plants on land that take up about half of what we put in. But in order to stabilize the water level, depends on how much water comes in from the tap and how much is removed. And as long as there's still more coming in from the tap than what's going out the drain, the water level is rising. So that's the situation we're in right now, that the tap has been being opened further and further and further. So the water is rising faster and faster. That's like the accumulation of carbon or parts per million in the atmosphere. And we know that we're just very, very close to out of time with our safe carbon budget for 1.5 degrees. So we only have a few more years until we've gone over the limit where we can expect to stabilize the climate at 1.5. So the next decade is really critical.
And so we get back to sort of the, what we can do then, because the state or EU or even the region are also super tankers in their own ways. So the only way to make this stop quickly is for us to change our behaviors. So where should one start? We passed the point where people patted themselves on the back because they changed light bulbs to LED. When you sort of published your research, you gained lots of traction because you said that one of the major things you can do to add more to your climate, your footprint, is adding kids. But still, that's probably going to happen. People aren't going to have kids, even though this might make you think a bit. I think I had mine, so I'm...
You should definitely keep them around at this point. Even if they're teenagers and you're a bit sick of them, you can't just get rid of them and claim it's a climate benefit. That's not allowed.
There are some times that you feel that there would be a quick and easy solution to that. At least adopt them to someone else. So what should we start with? If we're sort of trying to compile a list here of things where one should start that really makes a difference.
So let's start at the individual level, because you mentioned that. So in 2017, Seth Wines and I published a study on high impact personal climate actions. And that was because we constantly got asked exactly this question, what can I as an individual do that really makes a difference for the climate? And we didn't have a really good science-based answer. So we put together 39 sources, peer-reviewed studies and carbon calculators, and we came up with these four high impact actions. One is, as you mentioned, have one fewer child, so choose not to have a kid or an additional child. That one is important. It does have an impact. Of course, the more people we are, the more we're consuming and the more we're emitting to the atmosphere. But it's really important to understand that the method of our study was to look at the life cycle impact. And if we're talking about creating a person, that accounts for all future generations, so future descendants that person is expected to have. And that's really the reason why that number was so huge. So it is worth knowing that, you know, that personal choice does have a big climate impact. I think you don't need a scientist to tell you the choice to have a child has a big impact on your whole life. So I think you can talk to parents to get that information. So, I mean, that's one piece of data you can use in making that personal decision. But that certainly is a personal decision. That's not something that I would at all support is regulated or something like that. That should be recognized as a human right to make that decision freely. And it's also really important to understand from a climate perspective, we're not going to stabilize the climate by choosing not to have a child. And that's because the people who are alive today and the consumption that we're doing is already enough to use up our remaining carbon budget in just a few remaining years. So what that says is, okay, we actually have to change. Those of us who are alive here and now, we have to stop adding climate pollution to the atmosphere. And that's through our consumption choices. So that the things that really will work to stabilize the climate are reducing the emissions that we have today. And what our study showed, the remaining three choices that can do that quickly and effectively are going flight, car, and meat-free. So those are kind of the personal versions of some of the system changes that we need to make, namely to stop using fossil fuels and to switch to sustainable and regenerative agriculture.
And included in those figures that you published, that also sort of the life cycle analysis. When I stopped eating animals, that sort of has a ripple effect, goes through the industry and so on. So it's not just my personal footprint. It's the ripple effect that's calculated into that, right?
So our study included the carbon footprint, which is all greenhouse gases from the whole life cycle. So if we're talking about food, it would be emissions from the farm where the food is grown, the way that it's grown, transport, packaging, storage, preparation, disposal, that whole life cycle. We didn't include the kind of social effects that you're mentioning in that study, but other studies have. And that is really important because we do know from research that behavior does spread and is contagious. And if we have positive pro-environmental behavior, actually, especially if it's more high impact in these high impact areas, it's more likely to spread. So we have studies from Steve Westlake that have shown that for flying, that people who personally know someone who's stopped or reduced their flying are much more likely to do that themselves. There's the Flight Free campaign in Sweden that started here and now has spread internationally that has been really successful in making people realize how flying is basically the most climate polluting thing you can do hour for hour. There's just not room for frequent flying in the remaining carbon budget that we have. We know from other studies with solar panels that you're much more likely to get solar panels if your neighbors have solar panels. So there certainly are these kind of ripple effects. And I think that also has a really important role in helping to spread these behaviors. And then the last thing I'll say there is that we also know that we might think, oh, we need to get, you know, we might think of social norms and expectations like a vote, like, oh, we need to get, you know, 50% plus one or something to have this social tipping point. But actually, we know from a 2018 study, it's only 25% of a population that you need to reach. And that number was shown consistently in studies. Basically, as soon as you reached it, things could change essentially immediately. And there were examples where they were just short of that number, and then norms didn't change. So if we're talking about norms like what's seen as, you know, desirable and acceptable and aspirational in terms of where we live, how we move around, where we go for a vacation, what our consumption patterns look like, those norms can actually change really fast. And you only have to reach 25%. And that feels, I think, for me, really encouraging, because we know that there are a lot of people who are willing to change and or who have already made sustainable changes. And we're getting close to that tipping point, actually.
When you read different studies on the impact of your diet on the climate, there is a number of figures thrown around. I read the Jonathan Safran Foer's book, Saving the World Starts at Breakfast, I think it's called. I'll link it to in the show notes, where they find out that this sort of 25% of the global carbon emissions comes from an animal-based diet. And then there's an additional 25% that's sort of indirect emissions from transport and from sort of big animal farms and so on. How come your figure is lower? Do you know that?
I'm personally not convinced exactly by that number, but I think the important thing is we do agree on, which is we know that agriculture is second only to fossil fuels in driving the climate crisis. And we know that the vast majority of impact from agriculture comes from animal agriculture, so raising livestock. So that's really the key point to focus on, especially beef consumption. That's by far the biggest impact in terms of land and water use. But land use, it does use a lot of water and greenhouse gas emissions by far. So basically, in Sweden, for example, Ellen Roos and others have done a study saying, okay, we basically grow or raise five times too many animals for what we can actually afford to consume in terms of both a climate budget and a land budget. So if we kind of reimagine the system and say, okay, what kind of food system would we want? What would actually be healthy and sustainable? What could we produce here in the Nordic countries that would meet dietary requirements and, you know, help farmers and be sustainable from an ecological perspective? So they came to this conclusion, okay, we should only have livestock on leftovers. It doesn't make sense to be growing food that people could eat and then feeding it to animals. That's extremely inefficient. So we should have animals only where they can help us close nutrient loops. So eat waste that, you know, grass or food waste or other things that people can't eat, or where it's desirable to have grazing animals for landscape and biodiversity purposes. And that would mean many, many fewer animals raised for food than we have today.
So basically the way farming used to be, you used to have pigs in order to, they took care of all the scraps and then you ate them for Christmas. Going back to that old...
I mean, we don't have to only go back. I mean, of course, we can make use of progress and development and technology, but I think agriculture does need to fundamentally change. The kind of industrial system that we now have, which actually my family has been involved with for a long time. My grandfather bred what's now the main meat turkey in the world. So in a way, he kind of helped invent and develop factory farming. And that's a system we just have to get away from because the health and environmental price is too high.
I often ask my guests if they have three book recommendations they want to share. Obviously, we'll share a link to yours whenever that will come out. If you're a listener who wants to dive in a bit more in how you can make these changes and the effects that the climate have, your personal choices have on the climate, which book would you recommend?
Well, I can certainly recommend Seth Wines wrote a great book, which I think is being published in Swedish now, if it hasn't been already, but it's called SOS, What You Can Do to Reduce Climate Change. It's really short. It's really accessible. It's like a lot of bullet points. And he goes through the research both for personal lifestyle, so, you know, mobility and housing and food, what choices make the biggest difference. He also talks about political and collective action, which I think is really important because that is also a big part of the equation. I mean, for high emitters, we need to reduce our overconsumption through lifestyle changes, but we also need these system changes so that we have clean energy, we have zero carbon mobility, and it's possible to meet needs in a climate-friendly way. So that's a really great overview. I really like a book called Switch by the Heath brothers. I don't think they mentioned climate change at all, but to me, I read that book as completely about climate change. But I guess I just have like climate colored goggles on through which I see the world no matter what. But that's a very inspiring book because it's taking case studies and deriving principles from them of, okay, what actually works to make change? So here are examples from business and from charities and different initiatives around the world that have actually taken off and what made them work. And one key insight from that book is to look for bright spots. So basically they say, don't try to solve problems. You can ignore the problems and focus on what's working, figure out why it's working and how to scale it up. And I think that's very helpful advice in the climate crisis because there are plenty of problems and, you know, you don't need me to run down the list of them, but the problems are easy to find, but there are solutions out there. There are people who are taking action and that is working. And I think it's really helpful to acknowledge the scale of the problem. We can't hide from that, but then to motivate action, looking for basically combining what we like to do, what our talents and interests are, and where we can intersect that with what needs to be done for climate change. And that's really helpful. And then my third recommendation is actually climate fiction. It's called New York 2140. That's by Kim Stanley Robinson. And I've been in a climate fiction book circle. It hasn't been, of course, too active under Corona, unfortunately, but that's been really enjoyable. I think fiction and discussing fiction has been a really helpful way to think through a lot of things and to sort of emotionally relate to climate change. I mean, without a bunch of potentially dry statistics. I mean, as someone with a reverence for evidence, I don't want to, you know, poo-poo statistics, but it's a different experience to read fiction and to sort of empathize with and put yourself in someone's shoes and live through their life and see the world through their eyes for a while. And that book was really interesting to me because there is some science in there and kind of interspersed in an interesting way, but basically it's the story of society that completely failed to stop catastrophic climate change. So there's been multi-meter sea level rise. Much of New York City is drowned, but it's now, that was in the far past in this world. So, you know, 2140, the great floods were many generations ago by the time the story takes place. And I think it was really interesting for me to imagine, okay, what would life be like in that world? I mean, how would things go on and how would people think about it? And to me, that was almost the scariest piece of climate fiction I've read, even though there are ones that are much more dystopic, because essentially it was like, yeah, we waited around until it was too late to make the switch. But then we realized, oh yeah, we have to stop using this dirty rock. I think that could be quite realistic. You know, I think the transition to clean energy and sustainable agriculture, I think could actually happen much faster than we think, but we have to get started and make it happen.
I think we'll end on that sort of dark, but at the same time, very pragmatic note for this. Thank you so much.
Det där var alltså Kimberly Nicholas, lektor vid Lunds universitet och författare till boken Under the Sky We Make, How to be Human in a Warming World. Två saker som jag har tagit med mig efter vårt samtal är det här insikten om att vi måste fullständigt sluta släppa ut CO2 från och med 2021. För att ens ha chansen att nå målet att inte värma atmosfären mer än 1,5 grader. Och kom då ihåg att vi redan har värmt upp den lite mer än 1 grad. Men det mer positiva i det här är också att vi bara behöver få med 25% av befolkningen på den här förändringen för att det ska vara en social tipping point. Och det är faktiskt inte så många. Och sen det här med att, som också är kopplat till det, saker som du gör för att förändra ditt liv, det räknas faktiskt. Både för att du minskar egen påverkan men också på grund av att andra ser dig agera och det ger både hopp och inspiration. Och jag som själv försökt ändra massa saker de senaste åren för att liksom minska min påverkan kan vittna om att andra människor först är lite skeptiska och sen de lite nyfikna och sen visar sig att de också börjar göra saker. Så det där funkar faktiskt. Den lilla handlingen har en stor effekt. Vem tror du skulle uppskatta att höra just det här avsnittet? Ja, men tipsa dem med hjälp av knappen i appen. Det tar bara typ 3 sekunder och gör du det så blir någon annan glad för att du tänker på dem, för så funkar vi människor. När någon annan tänker på dig så blir du alltid glad. Lyssnar du på podden via Apple Podcast eller Acast, ja, men ge oss gärna ett högt betyg också. Det hjälper också att fler att hitta podden. Precis som om du delar den här i sociala medier och använder hashtaggen Perspektivpodden. Producent för Perspektiv idag är Jens Back. Klippte gjorde Hanna Brandén och det är Stray Dog Studios som mixat och fixat med ljudet. Jag heter Per Granqvist och Perspektiv är en podd från Vad vi vet. Vill du ha faktabaserade förklaringar av aktuella ämnen varenda dag? Men följ då Vad vi vet i sociala medier, Insta och Facebook till exempel, eller alla andra ungefär, där vi heter just Vad vi vet. Tack för att du lyssnat idag. Vi hörs snart igen.